Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're doing well, staying happy, healthy, and safe. It's a big show, so let's get right at it. Later on, we'll meet Roger Mooking. As a celebrity chef, restaurateur, television host, author, and award-winning recording artist, Roger has earned an international reputation as a multimedia artist and entertainer, showcasing a globally inspired vision that reflects his rich family heritage, love for people, and travel. He does a lot of things, and has even won a special All-Star Chopped Celebrity Chef episode. Today, we'll talk about his career in food and music, and how he combined all his interests in a new book called Curious Sounds. First, though, let's get to know number one New York Times bestselling novelist Karen Kingsbury. She is North America's favorite inspirational storyteller, with more than 25 million copies of her award-winning books in print. Her last dozen titles have topped bestseller lists, and many of her novels are under development with Hallmark Films and will soon emerge as major motion pictures. Today, we'll talk about how she found her way from journalism to writing best-selling fiction and her new film, Someone Like You, which she produced based on one of her books. Karen Kingsbury joined me via Zoom. Let's go back a little ways. We'll talk about the movie and everything else very soon. I wanted to ask you, though, about getting hooked on books. When you were age five, your dad read you The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, and apparently, from what I've read, this is the thing that drew you into the world of words. So tell me what it was about storytelling and maybe that particular story that appealed to you so much.
Well, Dr. Seuss is perfect at rhyming and rhythm. There was a rhythm to the words, and it was just like, what? You can dance with words. And it was so amazing. I mean, I was little, obviously, but I had younger siblings, and they always needed to be entertained. So pretty quickly, I memorized it. And I would use the book, but I wasn't reading yet, per se. I mean, I was like sort of reading, but I just memorized it and loved it. And it wasn't, you know, more than probably maybe a couple of weeks later that my parents stapled some pages together and gave it to me and said, you could write a book. You know, that could be something you do. And I sure enough did. And I loved it so much, I haven't stopped.
And you moved around a lot as a child. Did books become your kind of constant companion? Were they always the real constant in your life, as you must have gone through school to school to school?
Yes. Wow. You are absolutely right. Yes. My dad was with IBM. Mm-hmm. And back then they would say that stood for I've been moved. And he would come in and he would set up like a payroll system for a bank or something. And then 9 months, 12 months at the most, we'd be off to the next place. And yes, I loved reading. I fell in love with the Nancy Drew books and all the Laura Ingalls, you know, Little House on the Prairie books, and just really, truly would get lost in it. It was so fun to be in another world that was constant that I could turn to. And it wasn't really until I was in my mid-20s that my faith became something where, you know, then, yeah, Jesus is that constant companion no matter what happens. But back then it was reading and only reading, and I really loved it.
And were you making up stories at that point?
Yes. Like right from like at five, I wrote my first book. It was called The Horse, and every word was spelled wrong. But my mom saved it. She gave it to me on my college graduation, and it was, wow, the great gift to look back and see the faithfulness of God that, you know, he had led me to a journey that would make me into a writer, really. But then when I was like a little older, I started writing short stories, and they became more complicated. And my dad would read those, and I might've been 10 or 12 or 13. And he would get emotional, tears in his eyes, big smile. And he would say, Karen, one day everyone is going to know you're writing, and somebody has to be the next best-selling author. And I think it's going to be you. And that encouragement just kept me going.
So they were supportive, because the impression that I get, obviously working for IBM, button down, suit and tie, go to work 9 to 5, you know, working in banking and that sort of thing, it's not a life that I would imagine understands the arts and the idea of working as a writer and making a living as a writer.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And so when I graduated from college, I was a journalist for a while. They liked that. That was sort of the writer's version of the button down, you know, kind of 9 to 5 version, steady paycheck, that kind of thing. And yet still they believed in my dream to be a novelist. And that would only come after I did, four true crime books that came out of my days as a journalist. And when I really could no longer write any more of those, I started writing what we now call life-changing fiction.
And when you were at Pierce College, there was a moment when you decided that you were kind of sick of writing. And this has been a lifelong thing with you, but at that moment you said, I don't know if I want to do this. What brought you back to it?
Yeah, I'd reached a place where I thought maybe I would need to make more money. Honestly, it became that. My dad had gone through some really hard times. Then he was moving from IBM over to Parsons Engineering. And he went through a really hard spell where he took like a contracted job. And it didn't, after the contract was up, he was out of work for a while. And we had five kids in our family. And I remember going to the beach and thinking, I'm not going to make money as a writer. Like, I need to make more money. And I was intrigued by law. So I thought, I'll be a lawyer. I could, be a prosecutor or something, where I could make a difference that way.
You're listening to Karen Kingsbury on The Richard Krause Show. Her new film, Someone Like You, will be in theaters next week. Check local listings for times and locations.
And I took a Journalism 100 class at Pierce College so that I could forego English. It was like, this will be an easy A. I know how to write. I can do this. And I had Bob Scheibel as the professor in that class. He was an old, gritty veteran journalist. And we had about 300 students in that class. It was a big auditorium class. And we were maybe 3 weeks in. And toward the end of the class, Bob lowered his glasses a little bit and looked at the class, kind of sort of furrowed up his brow. And he said, "By the way, if Karen Kingsbury is in this class, you need to come and talk to me after class is out." And I thought, what have I done? Like, how bad were those first stories? So the bell rang and, everybody left and I went up to the front and I said, "Hello, sir, I'm Karen Kingsbury." And he kind of just looked at me for a moment and he said, "I got two things for you." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Number one, you're on staff. You report to my office tomorrow. You're going to be on staff for our newspaper. And number two, you are never, ever, ever going to stop writing." It was life-changing.
What influence did journalism play on the way that you write fiction? You talked about writing true crime. Obviously, that's not fiction, but now that you're crafting stories, you must have a journalist's eye for detail, maybe, or character, or what is it?
I mean, like, there's no question that my journalism training prepared me for what I'm doing now because I still have to research. My last book was Just Once was a historical love story set in World War II times. It flashes back to World War II, and it was so important to me to be accurate to that I would have the seal of approval from the historical society saying, "You nailed it. You've got the details right." That's the journalist in me. And also, I think I look deeper. I ask more questions. I lean into that character's persona and the why. Like, why are they like this? And what are we not seeing about them? Even on fictitious people, they feel that real to me. I think the other thing too is, I write quickly, and that's how you get trained as a journalist. You're on the sidelines of a football game. You got to turn your story in 15 minutes. Go. You got to do it. And when I write a novel, I outline, and each chapter becomes like an assignment. It's like, ready? Let's do it. Let's write. And I can write a novel in a couple of weeks as long as my schedule's clear. And that's the journalism training.
You have a list of questions that you answer before you write any of your books. Tell me a little bit about that process and how important it is to shaping what the book will finally be.
Well, it forces me to explore beyond the story. And that may not show up in the book, but it will show up in the way that character responds, how they speak, how they act in various situations. So it's really important. And I feel like I want to know them. Like, you and I are having this conversation, but it's not in depth enough for me to write about you. But if I spend 2 hours with you, I could find out what was the most traumatic thing that ever happened. What from your childhood shapes you today. If I can know those things about a character, then I'm going to give you a better experience reading than you would have ever had otherwise.
Your faith is an integral or plays an integral role in your life and in your family. Tell me how your faith carries on into your stories and influences the stories and the kinds of subjects that you want to write about.
Yeah, you know, to me, I mean, again, I in my mid-20s, life as I knew it changed when I met this guy, Donald Russell, who ended up becoming my husband. We've been married 35 years, and he was this, you know, good-looking Soloflex guy. He was in Soloflex commercials, you know, in LA. But he was so clean cut, and he didn't want to do the party scene, and he had just sort of found a Bible and started reading it. He wasn't like a certain denomination or faith, and he was very excited about it, and I thought he was the weirdest, like, handsome, weirdest guy I'd ever known. So, you know, through our discussions in those early months, I began to, he never was pushy about it at all. It was just, I ended up wanting to sort of debate him, and instead, God got my attention. And that relationship with Jesus becomes everything then to me. And it informs the things that I do and the decisions I make, even making a movie. I mean, it's been a part of everything. But how it winds up in the books really is that a secular author, and I've read so many books, and I certainly could have been a secular author and written that way, but you know, they're telling the physical, intellectual, and emotional parts of the story. When I write a book, I can do all of that, but I'm going to include the spiritual, and that means whether someone's running toward God or away from God, it doesn't matter where they're at in the spectrum. It's just that that layer is there. And I think the reason I have, you know, half my readers don't claim any faith. Like it's not just for people of faith, but they love it because the characters are deeper, and they're deeper because the spiritual, I'm not afraid of it. So I get to include that in the books.
Let's talk about someone like you. Not only a very successful novel, but you started a company to make the movie. So tell me about that process. It's a whole new way of looking at the world, probably, and probably it presents a whole new set of challenges. Tell me a little bit about creating this company and what you found, what you learned while making this movie.
Yeah, so when I wrote the last page of Someone Like You, which was it released during 2020, so during the pandemic early on. And when I wrote the last page, it was like I had this sort of holy chills that came over me that it and it was like I could almost hear God saying, "This is going to be your first movie." Now, I had felt that like calling to make my own movie because, you know, Hallmark's made movies and on my books and Pure Flix and just different entities, and they're always a blessing. I'm always thankful. There's beauty in all of them. But it was never quite the story that I saw on my heart when I first started that. Like that journey begins with this movie on my heart. I wasn't really seeing that necessarily. So my husband and I had a conversation, and we said, what I love about him is that he's a teacher, he's a coach, but always has believed in me, just like my dad always believed in me. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing. So he just put his hands on my shoulders and he said, you know, Karen, if we have to sell everything, like I believe we're supposed to do this.
Wow.
We had some savings at that point, and it's terrifying because when you write a book, you know, you're controlling everything, the set, the characters, the weather, it's whatever I want it to be. But when you're doing a movie, you have no control. Everything you had control over, no control. Like people can get sick, they could not show up, or I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong. And you know, everything about our schedule had to work just so. And I just felt like, you know what? It reminded me of when I was a sports writer back in my early days, where the Major League Baseball player will throw that pitch and it'll go faster over the plate, and the batter has a half of a second to decide whether to swing. We were sitting on an investment that had come to fruition, and we looked at each other and we said, you know what, let's swing. And I can only say, you know, the journey has been incredible. It's been nearly 2 years, and this side of it, on the cusp of it releasing, you know, nationwide and in Canada, I am absolutely thankful and no regrets.
Interesting that you say you can write a book in a couple of weeks, certainly, maybe sometimes longer, but this movie, I mean, you say it's a 2-year journey, and that's got to be or it must imbue in you a different way of thinking about the project because you're going to be living with it for a lot longer than usual. Was that a challenge for you?
It was, you know, I'm one of those strange authors that I'm super outgoing. Like I love people. I'm not the introvert that
Right.
you
The
see most.
hermit in a cave with a
Yeah.
typewriter.
I love people. And so one of the things I've enjoyed the most about this is how collaborative it is. And that started with my family. Like literally, We hired a local producer. She was getting us a crew from Nashville. We kind of sat around our kitchen table. She said, "Now you're going to need a line producer." And I said, "Line producer?" She said, "They'll handle SAG and insurance and payroll and all of the technical paperwork things." I said, "Just a minute." And I walked 25 feet to the left where my sister Trish has been my executive assistant for 15 years. She works at the home office here every day. I knocked on the door. I said, "Hey, Trish, Google line producer because you're going to be the line." So right away we had a family team. Then we involved this incredible cast and crew, and I got to be the leader, and that meant loving them. To me, a leader must love the people. That is the way to show. That's the best way to be able to make people see your vision is to love them through it, and then they catch it, and we go from sort of professional or even passive to passion. And our team has been passionate because I feel like they caught the vision.
Well, and it's personal too. This isn't some big nameless, faceless company making this film. They know where the money's coming from, and I'm sure you were there on set all the time and that sort of thing. So, that engenders a certain kind of commitment that you might otherwise not have had.
I really think so. We kind of committed up front, my husband and I, that we would feed them well. That's a small thing, but hey, if it's 40 degrees.
Listen, I've been on 1,000 movie sets doing this job. Food is way, way up at the top of the list.
It's so big. Like I could bring a coffee truck in or make grilled cheese sandwiches, and they were just like, "Yes, this is the best set we've ever been on." I really do. I love them still and care for them. And I'm so thankful for each one that I would consider doing it again because it's been such a fun ride.
Well, that was going to be the next question. Do you think this is, are you going to put on your studio mogul hat and do it again?
It'll depend on how someone like you does. Someone like you, it's got a huge buzz. People are saying one of the top movies of the year. And
You're listening to Karen Kingsbury on The Richard Krause Show. Her new film, Someone Like You, will be in theaters next week. Check local listings for showtimes and locations.
we started a Share the Hope campaign, and it has generated more interest than anything that Fandango has seen, which, that's here. But I think if it does really well, 100% we'll do another one. I love keeping my hands on it because then I know it's true to the story. Like I even made Pinterest boards on the costumes for each character. I made boards on the set deck, like how I saw this house for this character versus this house for this one. I picked half the sets, like half the locations of where we filmed. I went out personally and found those locations. That's how important it was that it became the movie I saw in my heart. And now when people go into the theaters on April 2nd, literally every second of it, I love it. I love it. I love it. And they're going to be able to see the exact movie that I had in my heart when I started the book.
And tell me a little bit about embryo adoption. What was it that made it stand out to you as a theme for someone like you?
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago. I was at a speaking event, and a woman I was talking to had three young triplets. And I said, "Your children are beautiful." And she said, "Yes, I adopted them as embryos." I had no idea that was a thing. And so, of course, as a journalist, and as a storyteller, I went home and I did some research and found out there are close to 1 million embryos that are in deep freeze, so cryopreservation, where people did their IVF and for one reason or another couldn't have any more children or were done having children, and then donated those embryos, which are 4-cell babies, into one of the many adoption centers that are now adopting those babies out. So I had no idea. This was like a whole, I feel like in some ways science is, raising questions that only God can answer. They're big questions and they're personal. And I don't have a statement to that end. I just say, for a family like this, where for health reasons they couldn't, the mom couldn't have that last embryo implanted, they donate the embryo. Like we just have a lot of possibilities there. And like I said, a story begins to form. So I don't think there's any other movie that has embryo adoption at its core. I think the main thing that young people and people who like just love to go see a movie, I think they're just going to say, "Wow, it's a great love story about someone like you." But the idea that they would be twin sisters separated at the petri dish who didn't know about each other, a family where they never told their daughter that she was adopted as an embryo, and where the other sister had no idea there was another embryo, it just raises these real questions. And for somebody else, it's a different thing. It's a different secret, a different tragedy, a different division. But at the end of the day, we get to watch this family suffer through some grief and some heartbreak and some betrayal. And then we see what can happen and what's possible. It's not always, everything isn't the perfect ending. We don't get London back, but we do get to see how there is, it's possible at the end of the day to still say we're going to be okay.
Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
A pleasure to speak to you, and congratulations on the film and continued success.
Thank you so much. We'll do it again.
You've been listening to Karen Kingsbury on The Richard Krause Show. Her new film, Someone Like You, will be in theaters next week, so check your local listings for times and locations. In this segment, we're going to get to know Roger Mooking. As a celebrity chef, restaurateur, television host, author, and award-winning recording artist, Roger has earned an international reputation as a multimedia artist and entertainer, showcasing a globally inspired vision that reflects his rich family heritage, love for people, and love for travel. He does lots of things, and he's even won a special All-Star Chop Celebrity Chef episode. Today, we talk about his career in food and music and how he combined all of his interests in a new book called Curious Sounds. Curious Sounds uses his most recent album, Soundbites, as kind of a scaffold for artists' conversations on creativity, family, grief, and lots more. The book is composed of essays by Francesca Ekuwase reflecting on art-making, storytelling, and creative expression, and Roger's multimedia visual art. There's some micro-stories that he wrote, music and lyrics. This book is a collage of ideas about making meaning through life's rhythms. He'll explain it all just a little bit later on in the interview. Here's Roger Mooking, who joined me via Zoom. I want to go way back, and I want to find out about your first memory of your love of cooking. You say it's when you were making wontons in the kitchen with your father. What was it about that experience that lit up your imagination?
That's my kind of my first experience interacting with food that really sat with me, it's just one of those kind of triggers, those emotional triggers. Is everybody has that thing. They smell it or they see or they hear somebody's making that one dish and it takes them back exactly to that moment. I can smell the smells in the room. I can hear the sounds. I can picture the whole environment. I can feel the energy of where my dad is over the shoulder. It's just one of those kind of foundational moments, that stick in your brain. So I think everybody has one of those,
Why did you tell your parents that you wanted to be a chef when you were just 3 years old? Because you couldn't possibly have known about all that other stuff.
Well, it's funny, I was with my aunt actually in Trinidad at the time. And, like aunts and uncles, what are you going to be when you grow up? Asking little kids. So she asked me that and immediately without blinking, I said I was going to be a chef. And now they come from their father running restaurants and bakeries. So they're like, oh boy, you got no idea what you're talking about. This business is crazy, So I didn't know. I just grew up with kind of a knowing persona and I knew that that was in my cards and I just called it that day.
You are a creative person. You do all sorts of things. We're going to touch on a few of them. But what is it about restaurants that keeps you going at it?
Restaurants are just a fulcrum of a community. They're such a meeting place. I've learned more in restaurants than I have in any type of education, any boardroom, any production facility, walking around the streets, talking to people. It really is a microcosm of the world. You have all income stratas moving through restaurants. If you're working at a really fancy restaurant, people are spending $300-$400 a head at the table. The people in the back in the kitchen are earning enough to do that, right? Or the dishwashers or the people prepping. And so you can experience the full range of the human experience inside of a restaurant.
You're listening to Roger Mooking on The Richard Krause Show. His latest book is Curious Sounds and is available now wherever fine books are sold.
And for somebody who's like just so attention deficit like me, who needs new information all the time, it's just the perfect environment. And you get to feed people, you know, food is love, man.
I learned so much working in restaurants. And as you say, you learn as much doing that as you ever will, you know, in a lot of other situations, simply because of the intensity of the situation. Yes. When you're dealing with people's food, it is a very intense situation. You've got to get it right. And if you don't, then, you know, people are unhappy. And that goes against the idea of hospitality. So it really is a learning experience every time you walk through the door.
Yeah, it really, really is. And then on the other side of it, from the business side, it's like, yo, you mess up two steaks in a night. That's the profit for the restaurant for the night kind of thing, you know? Yeah. So the stakes are really high. It's a high pressure environment. There's all kind of rogue characters who work and surround themselves in restaurants and come and are patrons of the restaurant. So it really is just, it's such a great testing ground for yourself as a person and for learning, you know?
So let's talk about your globally inspired cuisine. From my reading, it is that you, it began anyway, when you grew up with your Caribbean and Chinese background. And then when you were living in Alberta, you had a lot of Ukrainian neighbors and your mother would sort of get recipes from them. And it sort of grew from that. Is that about right?
Yeah, like I said, like a 3 years old man, I called it, you know, so the path that you see and walking, I'm walking right now, I just followed the path, you know, I didn't choose, or maybe I did choose to be in this family. I didn't choose to move to Edmonton, Alberta from Trinidad. And then when I came to Toronto to follow music and entertainment and stuff, like, there's just so many things along the pathway that just kind of led to this kind of approach to cooking. And, you know, one thing that really I stick with a lot that reminds me is, you know, I was training with these French, Swiss, German and French chefs, and they would say, do the stock this way. It's a very specific way you do the stock. Then I was working with this Chinese and Japanese chef. And you say, no, for this stock, we want to roll the stock, which is the complete opposite of what I learned from the French chefs. And they're both masters, you know, 30 years in the game. They're doing this forever. And that moment, I realized, like, oh, every rule that is hard and fast and true is not hard. It's not fast. And it's not true, because I got two different masters telling me completely opposing things. And that's what I love about food, is that I'll never learn everything in one lifetime about it.
I have a feeling that not following the rules entirely probably bleeds over into the music that you do as well, because the music industry is another business that is ruled by the old axiom, I think, where people say, you know, in the television business, which is mostly my business, and in the music business, which is yours, nobody knows anything. And you always have to be trying new stuff and breaking the rules to get ahead.
Well, you know, I think the more and more I live, the more I think every industry is like that. You know, I talk to people in accounting and finance and the stock market, or I might talk to somebody who's like washed dishes for years. And, you know, there's always a new way to do an old thing, and nobody really knows. I mean, if everybody knew everything about the stock market, everybody'd be a billionaire, right? If all the professionals in the stock market knew the game, there would be trillionaires in this, right? So clearly they don't know. They're just trying different things. And so I just embrace that with all things and just dive headlong, you know?
And as a creative person, someone who makes things that weren't there the day before, whether it's food or music or writing or whatever it might be, you say that the creative process is the same regardless of the craft. So regardless of whether it's cooking or it's making music, the creative process is the same. How so?
Well, I mean, of course, the tools change, the medium changes. You know, if I'm working with acrylics and paint, it's paint brushes. If I'm working in the kitchen, it's pots and pans and ingredients. If I'm working in the studio, it's instruments and voices. So those are all things. But at the end of the day, as long as we're still standing on human art, it's coming from an idea. A spark. Sometimes you don't know where this spark is coming from. You know how many songs I've written in my life that have come out that I heard in a dream, and then I realized, oh, this is not actually a song. I got to write this down. Right. And then, so it's just taking that and then taking your, you know, initiative and incentive and pouring your spirit into honing that idea to be as true to it as possible, or letting it evolve to become what it is meant to be. And you're just there for the ride, and you're sort of a conduit to it. So no matter what what your craft is, whatever your skill set is, in the arts, especially, we're just all learning and playing and experimenting and diving into the thing, and the medium and the tools change, but the process is very, very similar, you know?
How has traveling around the world for the various television shows that you're involved in influenced the music that you make?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a sort of like a musical nomad as much as I am a culinary nomad in that sense. You know, I came to making music through hip hop, and from hip hop at that time, I was sampling a lot. And right. So because I was sampling, I was looking for records. Like, we would stop on tour dates with Bare Naked Ladies, whatever, and hit the record store, you know, and we'd spend all day in a record store looking for breakbeats. And through that, I learned about rock music. I learned about Sesame Street music, some crazy music in Sesame Street and those 70s Spider-Man soundtracks is amazing music, right? Children's tutorial albums, Nana Muscuri, like just so many records of so many different genres that I was just enamored by because it was the feeling, right? And so it's just kind of picking up on that and running with it.
All of this comes together in a more recent project. This is called Curious Sounds. Yeah. And it's a book by Francesca Ekwuasi. She was inspired by some of your music. So tell me a little bit about this project and exactly what it is.
Yeah, so the birth of this just came about really earnestly. It started with, you know, like 19, I just saw the other day, I had a voice memo in my phone from 2019, right? And it said, sound bites, no song longer than 1 minute and 30 seconds. And so I was kind of sitting on that for a while, apparently. But then I stumbled upon this article where it said, like, the average attention span of the human now is less than that of a goldfish at 8.25 seconds. And so I was like playing with that in my brain, and like, you know, now it must be like 3 seconds because that was a few years ago, right? I was kind of really tossing. I was like, wow, what a condition. Like, I'm always thinking about the human condition, right? Mm. What a condition we've brought ourselves to that our attention span is so low. So I became really obsessed with that, along with my sort of malleable relationship with time to begin with. So I took that whole thing, and then I built this album called Sound Bites, where no song is longer than 1 minute and 30 seconds. The shortest song is 8 seconds, and it takes you through this journey of life, right? And unbeknownst, and it was such a crazy concept in listening to this thing, because it really takes you from conception to the end of life if you listen to the whole 19-minute journey, right? So then I was like, this thing needs some greater context. And unbeknownst to anybody outside of my family, I've been like painting and acrylics on canvas and stuff for like the last decade or so, a little bit over a decade. And I promised I would never release anything to the world because I have a really bad habit of taking all of my hobbies and turning them into a way to make money. So I was like, this one I'm going to keep sacred, right? And then the Sound Bites album was done. I'm like, but this needs a greater context. And so I started putting together visual work, some of this stuff. And I just followed the path and it just felt right. And I started putting together visuals that went with the songs. And then I was like, it still needs a little more context to it because I wanted to celebrate chaos in this moment.
You're listening to Roger Mooking on The Richard Krause Show. His new book, Curious Sounds, is available now wherever you buy fine books.
So I wrote these 100-word micro stories where, you know, no story is longer than 100 words, and they're very parabolic, I guess, parable-like, I guess would be a better word. So they're very parable-like, and I'm obsessed with those kind of stories. You know, a story that you read on a Tuesday and it means one thing to you on Friday, it means something completely different to you, and you see a perspective that you had no perspective on Tuesday. So I love those types of stories. I'm always going back to them. So I wanted to kind of endeavor to try and do something like that. So I put together this whole package and it's like, okay, how do we make sense of this? So I called my friend Francesca and I said, friend, you promised me that if I ever wrote stories or did a book that you would be my editor. That was the deal we made of the After Canon Reads, right? So I was like, well, here's the moment. Here it is. And she's like, I'm all in. I'm jumped in. So she jumped in and she started to do all the stuff around contextualizing all the music, all the visual work, all the micro stories, how our lives came together, how our lives came together in creativity, what brought us here, you know, the foibles and trials and tribulations of it all to bring us to this place, and how meaningful art is in that landscape, you know?
It's a book that delves into different things. All the way through this book, you're making larger points that are, I think, really interesting, but you do it in such a concise and interesting way that I think it makes Curious Sounds something really unique.
Yeah, thank you, man. It really is a celebration of chaos. You know, it's kind of the antithesis and the celebration of our short attention span,
right?
So it's bringing short stories down. But if you sit and read through those stories, one of those stories you can sit and think about for a month. So we're expanding that 100 words into a month now. Right. We're taking the music and the visuals and contextualizing them in a way that's very chaotic and sort of disparate, but they're all connecting themes if you want to follow that thread. And once you follow that thread, you realize this thing that's this very chaotic package actually has the breadth of an encyclopedia behind it. Right. And the thought of that type of inquisitiveness and the curiosity for new information and learning and trying to understand the human condition. I think that's what every person is trying to do.
I was doing some research for this, and I came to realize that the first time, and probably the last time, that I interviewed you was almost 30 years ago.
Wow.
You're
blowing me up now, Richard. You're blowing me up.
It was Bass is Bass. So I wonder now, as we sit here almost 30 years later, what would he have thought about where your life ended up?
I think in some ways it would be unbelievable. You know, I always had the dream of doing restaurants. And at that time, I was not in the restaurant game at all. I was just deep in the music thing. I never kind of envisioned returning to restaurants. And then that whole thing happened. And then the TV stuff around the food and beverage stuff happened. And I never stopped doing the music. I never thought that, you know, I would add the layer of being an author in this way, of writing stories or presenting visual art. That was never part of my understanding. But I come from a very creative family. My uncle's a photographer, my aunt's filmmaker, my grandmother's was an amazing seamstress, and my sister is a visual artist, a painter. Mm-hmm. So I'm surrounded with all these people in the arts. So I'm not surprised that I found yet another medium in the arts to kind of deliver through, or to like channel to be channeled through me, sort of thing. But I never imagined like this, you know. You can't imagine. You just got to walk the path, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Roger, thank you so much. What a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you so much, man. Richard, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully in the next 30 years.
We'll do it again in 30 years, and we'll get caught up.
I'm like the Black Margaret Atwood out here.
That was Roger Mooking. Check out his book, Curious Sounds, wherever fine books are sold. Big thanks to Roger. And a big thanks to Karen Kingsbury. Her new film, Someone Like You, will be in theaters next week. Check your local listings for times and locations. Of course, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk to you again soon.